Thanks very much for the invitation to speak. So you might have heard from someone that this is what our universe could possibly look like. There is this false vacuum, which is unstable to decaying into these expanding bubbles. And if the rate at which you form these bubbles is roughly slower than the Hubble time in this background false vacuum de Sitter, then you can never ever get rid of that de Sitter space. And you get something called eternal inflation, okay? So the story goes is that you make this huge diversity of different bubbles, and maybe this is motivated by the string theory landscape, but it doesn't have to be. And then inside one of these bubbles, you will find our observable universe. And this is a totally crazy idea, because it's saying that there's an infinite number, eventually if you wait long enough, of individually infinite universes. You can pack an infinite universe into each one of these bubbles in an infinite expanding background. And, you know, surely this is craziness and we can't be serious physicists talking about this. But, you know, this is a very short talk. I'll just give you a really quick motivation for why you might care, because this is a direct consequence of some very basic things that we think exist in most modern theoretical physics scenarios. So the first thing you need is a non-unique vacuum state. You need all the different possibilities. That happens in the standard model. It happens in beyond the standard model physics. It's inevitable in string theory. So it's motivated that one should at least consider non-unique vacuum states. You need quantum field theory. Quantum field theory tells you how to make those bubbles that I showed you in the movie. That's something that, at least at the perturbative level, seems to work incredibly well. So I believe that. And then the last thing you need is accelerated expansion. So you need some phase of accelerated expansion that ends or changes character locally inside of all these bubbles. And it's that phase of accelerated expansion that you just can't get rid of if you form the bubbles slow enough. And of course, we think that this is a key part of our cosmology. Something we observe today in the form of dark energy is something we infer happened in the past, inflation. So this is, I would argue, a very well-motivated idea. It's completely crazy, but it's very well-motivated by physics that is invented for different reasons, not just to come up with a crazy multiverse. So there's strong theoretical motivation, but of course you should ask yourself, is this idea in any way, shape, or form experimentally verifiable so we don't just argue from now until the end of infinity about it? And thankfully, the answer is yes. In certain cases, it can be tested. And the way that happens is by noticing that you have this big sea of bubbles and that whatever bubble we're in, it does not evolve in complete isolation. It's going to collide with other bubbles, and the collision of our bubble with others provides an observational test of this idea that we can go look for. So here's the big picture with some words attached to it. So we have some field theory which has multiple vacuum states, and it's got some positive energy vacuum state that gives us the accelerated expansion. This gives rise to this eternally inflating multiverse. This gives rise to a bubble that might have our universe in it, which collides with another, and then that leads to some possibly interesting observational signatures. And there's tons of interesting questions that I could spend hours talking about that you can get from, you know, follow this chain of reasoning to go from here to here and make predictions and then to actually look in the data and then hopefully constrain something about the fundamental theory. So here's a bubble. This is a space-time diagram. This is the wall of a bubble. If I look at the center and I look at a light cone emanating from the center, then that's the Big Bang of the universe inside of this bubble. And then you can foliate the interior of a bubble with open Robertson-Walker slices so that you have an epoch of slow roll inflation. You need that because the interior of the bubble is an open universe and we don't live in an open universe. So you need to dilute the curvature. And then you have reheating and CMB and all the interesting cosmology. Eventually you get to us today. So here's another bubble. It comes along, it smacks into us. Okay, so what are some basic features? What happens? How do we determine what the outcome is? Well, the first thing that I want you to note is that these collisions aren't happening. They're always in our past. Anything that comes into our bubble has to effectively pass through the Big Bang. So everything I'm going to talk about today is a perturbation of the Big Bang. Okay, so it's really a very early universe effect. That's totally key to understanding this. And the second thing to note is that the outcome, This is just field theory, right? It's classical field theory. It's nothing terribly complicated. So I have some bubble that's some configuration of fields. It gets hit by another bubble that's some configuration of fields. And so I can figure out what happens by, you know, solving the field equation with some initial conditions. So the outcome is totally fixed by the potential, the theory I have underlying this thing, and the kinematics. So that's all I need to figure out what goes on. Of course, it's not that easy because, you know, these objects are some nonlinear field configuration. Gravity is important because I want to talk about cosmology. So to really figure out what happens, you need full GR. So here are the reasons. It's, you know, GR because I want to talk about cosmology. There's some possibly huge center of mass energy released in these collisions. The potential is nonlinear. The field equations are nonlinear. So if you really want to do this right, you simulate it. So here's a movie of a simulation of two colliding bubbles. Let's say this one's ours and it contains a cosmology. And you can see just zooming in on this part where the collision happened, well, nothing that fantastical happens. You just get perturbations. So this bubble comes, smacks into us, and then we get some extra perturbations that live on top of this inflating background inside of our bubble. So here's some potential. Here again is that space-time diagram depicting some bubble collisions. There's a preferred cosmological slicing inside of this bubble, which gets perturbed, as I showed in that movie before. So then inflation happens. It takes this and it stretches it out so that what we would see today is a universe that's roughly split for a single collision into two pieces. One piece that's unperturbed, that's this piece over here, that's just the open Robertson-Walker universe with nothing interesting in it, and then the perturbed piece, which is the part that's in the future light cone of this collision. So that's the rough story. So if that thing I showed you was the surface of last scattering, maybe it's a potential perturbation on the surface of last scattering, you can see the universe here is split into two pieces. Here's just another picture of that. That's like a space-space diagram. So if I project my past light cone, here's the universe perturbed, here's the universe unperturbed, and I see some piece of this perturbation. Symmetry plus causality basically tells me the shape. Okay, so this is inflation, the size of my past light cone relevant to any scales that have to do with this pre-Big Bang physics is tiny. So whatever it is, for me it basically just looks completely planar. And what's the intersection of a sphere with a plane? It's a disk. Okay, so just from symmetry and the fact that the bubble collision can't propagate arbitrarily far into our bubble by the time of last scattering tells me that the effects are going to be confined to a disk. And thanks to the stretching power of inflation, I can basically do a Taylor series expansion around that point. And the lowest order term I'm going to get to the temperature perturbations in the CMB effectively looks like a cosine. So this perturbation will induce a temperature variation inside the disk that roughly goes like the cosine of the angular distance away from the center. Something you can derive analytically. It's also something that you can get from the numerics. If you want to ask me about that, I'm very happy to talk about that because I think that's probably the most recent result that I present here today. Unfortunately, 15 minutes doesn't give me enough time to describe it. So here's what it would look like. Right, I've got some background CMB fluctuations, and then buried in there, because we don't look up and see this giant disk on the sky, it's got to be buried in there, otherwise it's not already rolled out, you'll have this roughly circular looking template. Okay, so how many do I expect to find? Is this like a needle in the haystack, or do I actually expect the theory to predict these things to be out there? Well, that's something you can calculate. If you calculate the collisions whose disk is smaller than the whole sky, there are things that are going to be so big they cover the whole sky, that would be like a long wavelength modulation. Forget about those for a second, but the number of these disks in the sky is fixed by lambda, that's the probability per unit pore volume that I get bubbles from the false vacuum. This is the Hubble scale in the false vacuum, this is the Hubble scale during inflation, and that's the present day curvature today. Okay, so that's a tiny number. This is a quantum mechanical tunneling that's producing these bubbles, so this is an exponentially suppressed number. We know from observations that this is small, So the square root of omega curvature is probably less than about 0.1, 0.01. And then you have this ratio, which is potentially large. Okay, so the price of entry, the theories that you constrain, are theories which have a large hierarchy between the false vacuum Hubble scale and the inflationary Hubble scale. Those are the things that we can test. And you can derive the properties, the statistical, so you know, you form these bubbles from different places in the false vacuum, and they'll show up as different sized disks. And you can derive the probability distribution over sizes. It roughly goes like the sine of the size on the sky. So the most probable bubble to find is one that eats up exactly half of the sky, really big stuff. Okay, so a recap of that very quick summary. Here's the model. I've got some potential. This is your favorite, you know, theory of the string theory landscape, or maybe something simpler. And that gives rise to eternal inflation. And from there, you have this ensemble of possible CMB skies with these collisions in it. Unfortunately, there's a generic signature, so I can kind of decouple this part from the potential and actually do something without knowing, you know, the theory of the string theory landscape, which no one knows. And okay, we'd be going home, we wouldn't be talking about this. So what is the model? It's a number of expected collisions. That's the formula I showed you on the other slide. It's some parameters characterizing each collision. That would be like the amplitude. And then some probability distribution, which tells me how much of each type do I expect to find. And that's my theory. Okay, is it in the data? So here's what it would look like if it was totally exaggerated and, you know, we looked in COBE and we saw these disks on the sky and we're wondering what they were. But of course, we don't live in that universe. We live in this one, where if they're there at all, they're buried. So does the theory prefer a theory? Does the data prefer a theory with collisions? And so we'll do what any good Bayesian does. We'll find this ratio of the posterior. So I want to figure out the probability of some model given the data divided by the probability of some other model given the data. And this roughly tells me how I should bet. So what are the models? We've got lambda CDM and lambda CDM with these interesting disks in it, which follow some probability distribution. And a very convenient theory label, because I just want to talk about all theories which give rise to these bubble collisions, is this total number of expected features. And that's very convenient because lambda CDM is just that the expectation value is zero. Okay, so here's the CMB. And let's say I could find that probability distribution. Maybe it looks something like this. If it was this, that would be no detection. If it was one of these guys, we'd be in business. And to calculate this, you need to test for an arbitrary number of templates, because n is just a free parameter. At an arbitrary position on the sky, they're equally likely to be anywhere with some arbitrary amplitude, shape, size lying within this prior. And of course, implementing that calculation is totally impossible, so you have to be more clever. The clever thing you can do is to first locate all of the candidates using some blind analysis, and then you can find an approximation to the probability by integrating over only the regions of parameter space where the contribution is large. And because one of our parameters is positioned on the sky, that means we only have to integrate over regions which are likely to contain a bubble collision, or most likely to contain one. So let's say I found one candidate, it's there. I carve that piece of data out of the sky, and I can calculate this evidence ratio. So that's basically how much better do I describe the data by adding a template here. Okay, so we do that by integrating this likelihood. We calculate that, you know, it's a pixel-based likelihood, so that's gonna contain cosmic variance, the beam, spatially varying noise, all that good stuff in the covariance matrix. And then we assume some prior on the size, position, amplitude, and shape. We could bicker about that, but anyways, that goes into this number here. And you do that for each one of these features, and then you sew it together into a statement about the global theory. Okay, so this is the probability that I have some expectation value n given the data, and this F sky is the fraction of the sky that we actually observe. You need to account for the fact that you have to cut out the galaxy and such. You don't have all the data on the full sky. And you know, this is a horrible, complicated formula. Basically, it's just summing over all of these independent assessments of the different candidates. OK, Okay, so how do I sew all of these independent assessments into a global statement about the data? So what does the data say? Here's the WMAP W band. That's the highest resolution band that WMAP has. Here are the candidates up here. So these are the things that from the blind analysis might be bubble collisions. Here's the parts of the data we actually analyze around each of these candidates. And here's the answer, which is sort of disappointing, that the probability distribution is peaked around zero. Okay, so the data does not favor a theory with any number of bubble collisions in it. And here's the constraint. So from the shape of the posterior, you can basically constrain that this expectation value has to be less than about 1.6 at 68% confidence level. So if you hand me a theory of eternal inflation that predicts I should see more, it's wrong. Okay. So the punchline of this talk is that this crazy idea of the multiverse is a testable theory in some cases. So it's not like you can rule out every single possible theory in principle, but you can in principle test many theories, and you can in principle constrain them. So the two big open questions, first of all, you probably want to know what happens with Planck. We're working on it right now. The second thing you want to know is, what did we actually constrain? And that's a great question, which we're also working on right now. So thanks very much for your time.
So how much does the choice of priors influence all of this stuff?
Not so much. So what we're another thing we're doing right now is to do a little bit better job of deriving the priors from first principles. So you can, now we have the facilities to actually simulate these collisions and extract the observational signature. And it's just a stochastic process, the process of bubble formation. So you can then just kind of do a Monte Carlo type simulation and figure out what the probability distribution is really. So these are just guesses right now, but you can figure out what they are really. My strong suspicion based on preliminary results is that it basically looks like what we assumed. And honestly, it doesn't really matter that much. It's data driven. We'd probably be bickering about it more if I told you there was some lump at, you know, five. But yeah, it's mostly data driven. Yes.
Could you go back to the early slide where you show this cartoon of the bubble forming in this?
This one?
Yeah. So you first have your exponential expansion, and then you're adding an extra inflation of the bubble formation.
That's right.
But why? For
observational necessity.
Okay.
So in fact, these models were invented in the 90s because we thought we lived in an open universe. And this is a natural way of getting an open universe from inflation.
What does open mean?
The spatial curvature is open.
Oh, okay.
So in the Robertson-Walker metric, you've got k equals minus 1. Right? So that's why they were invented. And then if you have a period of slow roll, you can basically adjust the curvature today to be whatever you want. The modern reason why they're interesting is for the motivations that I introduced at the beginning of the talk. Why in that picture do we live in a universe that looks so flat? That's a great question. Hopefully that's a prediction of the theory that would be somewhere in there and confirmed. But for the purposes of what I showed you today, that's an input. We conditionalize on the fact that in our universe, the curvature is small.
Okay, one last question.
Uh-huh.
Just something which, with this you are probing eternal inflation, but does this assume a specific landscape? I'm always a bit confused if it's probing, let's say, the multiverse in string theory that is the landscape and internal inflation, or only internal eternal inflation.
So you don't need the landscape. All you need is a scalar field theory with a potential that looks like that. That's it.
Eternal inflation at an end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But of course, the string theory landscape provides more motivation, perhaps, for thinking of these ideas, because it gives you a theory with, that times 10 to the 500 or whatever. So maybe then you know, you're sort of more forced to care about it or think about it. But you know, just to give an example, in a standard model, if there's no physics between a TEV and the Planck scale, then the vacuum we inhabit is unstable, and it's going to decay in, you know, a long time, but it's going to decay eventually. And that decay rate is sufficiently slow that the rate of bubble formation is much slower than the current observed Hubble. And so we live in an eternally inflating universe, if that's true.
There seems to be a bit disagreement on this. I'm not the particle physics, I don't know, but some people say that the Higgs was found exactly in the window to be stable after the Planck scale, and some say it's outside.
It's like almost exactly right at the Planck scale. So, which is a very interesting thing independent of that, that might have something to do with some very interesting physics. But yeah, sure, it may be a little bit past the Planck scale, but it's close. Yeah. But it's a pretty drastic assumption to think that there's a desert between a TV and a Planck scale. I hope that's not true.
We all.
You at least need the dark matter problem.
Yeah. So that's a great question. So I wonder what, you know, if you add that extra particle in there, that does to these estimates. But it probably depends on how it couples to the Higgs.
Okay, let's thank Matt again. So our next speaker is Manuel Kremer, and he will tell us about observation effects from graduated quantum cosmology.
Okay, first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here as a representative of a more alternative approach to quantum gravity. And the topic is how to extract potential observational effects with respect to the CMB from relativistic quantum cosmology. And this is joint work with my supervisor, Klaus Kiefer, with whom I wrote the first two papers. And then for the third paper, we joined forces with Donato Bini, Gianpiero Esposito, and Francesco Pessina, from Donato Bini from Rome, and these two from Naples. OK, the main motivation for quantum gravity, I think I don't have to talk a lot about this, is, of course, that we have a problem that we have several approaches. And we need some observational guidance to distinguish these theories. And of course, the big problem is that quantum gravitational effects should only become sizable if in the Planck regime, so for energies evolving in the scale of 10 to the 19 GeV. And therefore, you can only expect effects for black holes, but Hawking radiation, fortunately, is very weak. Or the very early universe, and in this case, the cosmic microwave background, and most of the searches for quantum gravitational effects, of course, focus on this CMB, and I'm also going to do this. So the relativistic approach is kind of the predecessor to loop quantum gravity. It's also a canonical quantization of a Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity. You also use this ADM formalism to decompose your space-time into special hypersurfaces. And then you use as canonical variables your induced spatial free metric and its conjugate momentum, and then you use the Dirac quantization procedure. And from the Hamiltonian constraint, you get this relativistic equation, which is a functional differential equation for a wave function defined on what Dirac called the superspace of all free geometries. And this equation is very complicated, so it's a functional differential equation. It has some mathematical difficulties. So here it's written again. And you see that this equation is timeless. So in the sense that in GR you have a dynamical time intertwined with space, and in quantum mechanics it's an absolute parameter. So in this case, if you use this polarization procedure, the equation becomes timeless. And it's unlikely that this equation will be the final answer to quantum gravity, but the point I want to make here is that it should hold as an effective equation. because in a sense it's constructed like this, that if you use a semi-classical approximation, so a von Oppenheimer type of approximation with this parameter g, with a gravitational constant proportional to Planck mass squared, then you can recover the Einstein equations by in the Hamilton-Jacobi form. And if you proceed with this approximation scheme at the next level, you get a functional Schrödinger equation for a matter field you can introduce here. And you can also recover WKB time. And so you recover, on top of the Einstein equations, also quantum field theory in curved space time. And then it's, of course, nice to proceed with this approximation scheme. And on the next step, as it was done in this paper from 91, you get a Schrödinger equation with quantum gravitational correction terms. And our aim was then to use this quantum gravitationally corrected Schrödinger equation to calculate the most dominant quantum gravitational contribution for the power spectrum of some cosmological perturbations. And we used the simplest possible model, which still leads some interesting results, which is an inflation of the universe, but we only use perturbations of the scalar field, so we did not care about gauge invariant variables, but we only used the simple perturbation of the scalar field, and our background universe is, of course, a flat Lippmann-Lambert universe with a scale factor A, which is now and then rewritten as exponential of alpha for convenience, and we introduce the interpreton field pi. And then we, of course, you also use the Slowell approximation such that our interpreton potential becomes approximately constant. And then we decompose our fluctuation modes, and this then becomes this variable fk. And then after setting h bar and c equal to 1 and redefining the Planck mass for convenience, we get a relativity equation for each of the perturbation modes. This looks like this. So you have here the background Hamiltonian and then the perturbation Hamiltonian. And this is, in a sense, similar to the Halliwell and Hawking approach from 85 in the sense that we just used then the variables fk. And then we use this relativity equation to perform a semi-classical approximation. And we use this WKB ansatz, e to the is, and then the von Oppenheimer approximation is implemented in that way that we expand s in terms of powers of the Planck mass, like this. And then we insert this this ansatz into the relativity equation and then equate terms of equal power of the Planck mass. And then we recover the Friedmann equations in the form of the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And then at the next level, we can define wave functions, psi k, which are proportional to e to the is times a pre-factor, which then can be made to vanish. And this wave function then obeys a Schrödinger equation like this, if you then introduce a WKB time in this sense. This WKB time is then comes from this this solution of this Friedmann equation, and kind of then you can introduce this WKB time and you get this nice Schrödinger equation. And then in the next step, you get this quantum gravitationally corrected Schrödinger equation. We have here two terms. They are both suppressed by 1 over the Planck mass squared. And we focus here on the first term because this gives the dominant contribution. And we use then this equation to calculate the power spectrum and this equation to calculate the correction to the power spectrum. So this is done like this. We solve the Schrödinger equation just with a Gaussian ansatz. Like this, we have the normalization factor and then this parameter omega, which is more or less the inverse Gaussian width. And then if you evaluate the density contours at the time when the modes re-enter the Hubble radius, you can relate this to this expression at the time when the mode exits the Hubble radius. And it turns out after some calculation that this is just proportional to k to the minus 3/2. So you recover the standard power spectrum of inflation, because then this gets multiplied by k to the cube, kk cubed, and you get that usual almost scale invariant power spectrum. And then in order to solve the quantum gravitationally corrected Schrödinger equation approximately, we just used the simple ansatz to add terms to the normalization factor and to this inverse Gaussian width suppressed by 1 over Planck mass squared. And we implemented the boundary condition that omega k goes to zero as the perturbation as t goes to infinity. And then we get a quantum computationally corrected power spectrum, which is just the normal usual power spectrum times a correction factor ck, which has the following form. So it has 1 plus some factor and o over k cubed. And well, maybe if I have time later, I can say a bit something about this sign, because we had some issues with this, which were then discussed in the new paper from 2013. But if I have time later, I can discuss, I can tell you more about this. So this then leads to an enhancement of power on large scales. And if you then use the uncorrected power spectrum and define it like this with this subway parameter epsilon, and then you can also rewrite this correction term like this. So you define the most dominant correction term delta Miller-DeWitt in this form. Then you can find expressions for the spectral index, which looks like this. So you have the normal expression from inflation minus the 3 times delta Miller-DeWitt. And also the running gets modified, so you have the usual expression from inflation plus 9 times this parameter Miller-DeWitt. And but unfortunately, this correction is very weak, because we have an upper bound on the ratio of h over the Planck mass from the tensor to scalar ratio. And in the most recent Planck data, r is constrained to be less than 0.11. And this means that h over mp is less than 3.5 times 10 to the minus 6. And this means that delta Miller-DeWitt is smaller at k equal to the Pippet scale. So k here in our case is dimensionless, than 2.2 times 10 to the minus 9, which is really, really weak. So if you compare this to the Planck results, these are the usual results for the spectral index and its running, you see that these corrections get completely drowned out by the statistical uncertainty. And it gets worse, because cosmic variance is most prominent on large scales. So even if there are new satellite missions and so on, we cannot expect that this becomes better, the situation for these corrections. But we can use it to get some constraints on the Hubble parameter H, so in a sense, on constraints on the energy scale of inflation, because we haven't seen effects like this in the CMB up to now. So we can say that the C for k equal to the Pippet scale has to be less than 1.05, because otherwise we would have seen some effects like this. And if you require this, then you get an upper bound. H over MP is less than 10 to the minus 2. But this is, of course, much, much weaker than the bound we already have from the tensor to scalar ratio. So to briefly compare this with loop quantum cosmology, so we have several approaches to this. One is, for example, the inverse volume correction by Buyeval, Pekani, and Tsujikawa. And they also get an enhancement of the power on large scales. And this gray part is the limit imposed by cosmic variance. And they actually can get with some, they can change some parameters. And they could actually get into observational, that their results become observable. And also the pre-inflationary dynamics approach by Aguyo, Ashtika, and Nelson. They get some oscillations here, but mostly it's also an enhancement. And this also looks that depending on the, I think, the value of the potential at the bounds, it can become observable. And of course, there will be in the future probably further results on anomaly-free holonomy corrections, as it was mentioned by Barreau on Monday. And of course, Guillermo will talk about his approach in hybrid quantization, what can be learned from this in the future. Okay, so to sum up, we quantized an inflationary universe with just perturbations of a scalar field, a la Miller-DeWitt, and used a semi-classical approximation to this Miller-DeWitt equation, and then derived the power spectrum of these perturbations and quantum computational corrections to it. This correction term that induces a scale dependence, and the power gets modified on large scale, on the largest scales. But unfortunately, it's too small to be observable, and even in the future, it will still be too small because of cosmic variance. But we could get some kind of consistency check because we have a weak constraint on the energy scale of inflation, which is compatible also with other observations. So, and then of course, the aim is to compare this with other approaches to quantum gravity, and here, loop quantum cosmology in the sense of inverse Baldwin corrections and in pre-inflationary dynamics also leads to enhancement of power on large scales. So here are some references, and that's all. Thank you for your attention.
Is it always an enhancement? Is there anything to learn from that?
I think that here it might be that they have done calculations in with tensor modes, and there I think it's a suppression of power, or
we have a flat bit which is flat, okay. And then we have an oscillator which is it's kind of cone-like, but it's
okay.
And then we have the exponential, but the observer window end up in the exponential increasing part, then it's ruled out. But on the other hand, that's the waves that is transplankian,
okay.
Doing bounds, and we didn't really trust our effective approach to work on them. If you want to see the spectrum, there's a poster.
Okay.
But it's quite different from this.
Yeah. So there seem to be some indication, but I don't think that it's yet settled that it's
obvious. I think it depends a lot. If you evolve the perturbations through the bounds,
okay.
You pick up a lot of things happening in the bounds. But in Asseker, always starts at the bounds, and then you don't get so much different from standard cosmology.
Okay.
So how do the magnitudes of these effects compare? I mean, you said in both cases you get an enhancement of power, but you...
Yeah, but the loop effects are much more prominent, so they could actually be observable, depending on several parameters, like the, as I understood it, the potential, the value of the potential at the bounds, and here you can also tune some parameter. So they can become observable, but in the bit case, it looks like this can't become observable.
I mean, just a question because I cannot follow it all the details. You're calculating the sub-living order in the expansion in the plant mass, okay?
Yes.
For the perturbations. Would be the living order in the second perturbation of the same magnitude or not? Would be just something negligible with respect to.
You mean in if you have this.
Yeah, you have the action, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you have been expanding what you call S1, okay?
Yes.
The leading order and the subleading one that was in an expansion in the plant mass. So my question is whether you include higher order perturbations, whether they will be also negligible with respect to that correction.
You mean already at the first level that...
essentially, you truncate in quadratic order in the perturbations. In the
yes, yes. I kind of believe that we don't really think about this, but I think it's unlikely. Yeah. I think that these effects are even so small that I think going to the next order and also non-Gaussianities, this will still be too small to get some sizable.
Thanks.
So our next speaker is Sanjeev Sierra, who will tell us about primordial polymer perturbations.
Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers very much for having me and also for changing my talk time based on my inability to properly book a flight. So I very much appreciate that. So today what I'd like to talk about is primordial polymer perturbations. So this is something to do with polymer quantization. So just by way of introduction, we know there's plenty of approaches to quantum gravity. There's string theory, loop quantum gravity, many other types of approaches. All of these involve interesting ideas. So string theory brings to the table the notion of extra dimensions. Loop quantum gravity brings to the table the notion of polymer quantization. That is, namely, that standard Schrodinger quantization should be modified at high energies. So certainly from a cosmological point of view, this has been explored a lot. There have been brain world models, all sorts of different types of inflationary models making use of extra dimensions. This hasn't been investigated to the same level of detail. So that's what I'm proposing to do today. So what we've been interested in is the polymer quantization of a scalar field. So we're going to consider a polymer quantization of a scalar field, and it's going to correct quantum field theory at high energies. So it's going to have a number of effects, and actually we talked about a number of effects that don't have anything to do with cosmology or peripherally related. So we looked at dispersion relations, we did look at some quantum cosmology of a polymer quantized scalar field, the free particle propagator, primordial perturbations, black body radiations. These things have all been considered. So in this talk, I'm just going to talk to you about these things, the effect of polymer quantization on the generation of primordial perturbations. I just want to highlight Verkar Hussain's plenary talk on Friday, who's going to talk about some of these other things, some subset of these other things. Okay, so what are the basic properties of polymer quantization? I think a number of people are probably familiar with it, so I'm going to go through this quickly. Schrodinger quantum mechanics, the physical states are naturally delocalized in a position. You know you've got a delocalized state. In polymer quantum mechanics, we actually are going to allow states in the physical Hilbert space that are localized to a given x. That is, we're going to allow these states to be normalizable and located in our physical Hilbert space. Or stated another way, for each value of x, I'm going to associate a discrete quantum state. So I'm going to have this notion of fundamental discreteness. So for each value of x on the real line, I'm going to have this quantum state. So what are the effects of this? Okay, in Schrodinger quantum mechanics, it's we know the action of momentum and translation operators. It's simple to see. If I want to calculate the momentum of a wave function, I differentiate it. If I want to translate it, I just pick it up and I translate it. In polymer quantum mechanics, it becomes a little more difficult. Translation operator is still well-defined. I can take one of these discrete states here that's associated with a given value of x and pick it up and move it. That's no problem. But it's more difficult to define a Schrodinger-like momentum that's heuristically kind of like a derivative here. You can say this more formally, but this is generally the picture proof of that. Schrodinger-like momentum is not really well-defined in the polymer setup. So what should we do? We should replace our notion of momentum in polymer quantum mechanics with something else. So we have Hamiltonians, and Hamiltonians have momentum in them, and we need to represent those momentum by something. So why don't we use something like a finite difference stencil? So this is kind of like as if we were solving, approximating a derivative on a computer. So I can compose an approximation to the derivative out of translations. I can take a function, move it this way, take a function, move it that way, take the difference, and divide by the amount that I moved it, and that will be an approximation to the derivative. So that's how I'm going to represent my momentum in this polymer setup. Now, when I do this, I have a width of a stencil here, and that's going to define an energy scale. So when I replace my polymer, Schrodinger derivative operator with this finite difference stencil, I'm going to have a finite width, and that's going to define an energy scale of this quantization. I'm going to call it M star. For energies much less than M star, I'm going to recover the Schrodinger quantum mechanics. For energies much greater, I'm going to get deviations from Schrodinger quantum mechanics. So let's do an example, and I'm going to do this example because it's going to be relevant for what I do later. So let's talk about the polymer simple harmonic oscillator. So find the energy eigenvalues of a polymer quantized simple harmonic oscillator. The Hamiltonian is this. Of course, I don't have access to this momentum operator here, so I'm going to replace it with this polymer version like so. So instead of working with that Hamiltonian, I'm going to work with something like this. And here the M star scale is 1 over lambda, where lambda is the width of this finite difference stencil. Okay, to solve this problem, I can do a couple things. I need to represent my wave function somehow, so I could work in a position eigenstate basis. So I can introduce a lattice along the x direction like so that's evenly spaced, and try and represent my wave function as a superposition of these states that satisfy these kind of relations here. Turns out, for this case, it's easier to work in a momentum-like basis. That's cut off there. Yeah. Let's see if I can get that. That was no good. Okay. The momentum basis satisfies, and it's back again. The momentum basis satisfies those things there. Okay, so working in that momentum basis, if I just project the eigenvalue equation down into that basis, I'm going to get a differential equation that's of this type here. So this is the eigenvalue equation in my polymer setup. Now, very important in this eigenvalue equation is this polymer coupling, this combination of parameters here, the mass of the oscillator, omega, and this polymer energy scale squared. Basically, the polymer coupling tells us how close to Schrodinger we actually are. As g goes to 0, we recover the regular kind of eigenvalue equation we would expect for the simple harmonic oscillator in Schrodinger quantization. And I'm going to also just impose some Dirichlet boundary conditions on this wave functions in order to recover the simple harmonic oscillator as well. So the polymer coupling tells us, it gives us a notion of how close or how far away we are from a Schrodinger regime. So I can go ahead and I can solve this eigenvalue problem, and it's analytically solvable, and here are the wave functions, here are the eigen energies. So you can see for small polymer coupling, I get something that looks like the regular wave functions for the simple harmonic oscillator. For large coupling, I get something that looks like trig functions. I recover the ordinary spectrum down here, I get a different spectrum for large polymer coupling, like so. So we can do this. What does it have to do with cosmology? Well, let's move on to primordial fluctuations right now. So the problem I want to consider is an inhomogeneous massless scalar in a de Sitter background of this type, like so. And the goal is I want to come up with the power spectrum of fluctuations produced during inflation, assuming some polymer quantization. I'll just mention as a note that even though I'm considering the massless scalar on a de Sitter background, this works equally well for this if I was quantizing this gauge invariant in standard slow roll inflation, where the script phi there is supposed to be the inflaton. Okay, so how does quantizing inflationary fluctuations work? We saw a bit of this in the last talk, actually. First, there's the textbook Heisenberg algorithm. So what you do is you take the scalar field Hamiltonian, you promote the field and its momentum to operators, you construct a Fourier transform, like so, and you demand that this operator satisfies the classical equations of motion. So you have a time-dependent expansion coefficient here, and when you demand that, it means that this thing satisfies a second-order differential equation. You solve that differential equation with boundary conditions that recover flat quantum field theory in the past. And the power spectrum is just you get it from squaring up this expansion coefficient in the superhorizon regime. Okay, this step is complicated in the polymer picture. It's not impossible, but it does lead to some very some ugly looking expressions. So what we want to do is apply an alternative algorithm that's quite closely related. So instead of promoting to operators, then Fourier transforming, we're going to Fourier transform at the classical level, which reduces the Hamiltonian down to a collection of disjoint Hamiltonians for each K mode. I'm going to separately quantize each of those in the Schrodinger picture, like so. And then what I'm going to do is evaluate the power spectrum by evaluating the expectation value of this operator in some suitably defined ground state. And the point here is that this is just a collection of simple harmonic oscillators with time-dependent parameters. So I can just go ahead and quantize these simple harmonic oscillators using my polymer methods. And that's exactly what I'm going to do here. So really what I've got to do is solve a version of the Schrodinger equation that comes from polymer quantum mechanics. And this is what it looks like. After some manipulations, or lots of manipulations, we get something like this. And you'll notice that this is the exact same equation I flashed up for the polymer simple harmonic oscillator, but importantly, the polymer coupling is now time dependent. So this polymer coupling that shows up here is now the ratio of the physical wave number of a mode, K over A, over the polymer energy scale. And this is something that's quite physical here. It means that in the early time limit, the evolution is very much modified by polymer quantum mechanics. That is, when the universe is small, then this thing corrections become large. But in the late time limit and the end of inflation, the quantum state evolves as in ordinary Schrodinger quantization, like an ordinary simple harmonic oscillator. So this is what we need to solve. Thanks. So we need to set up initial conditions. So we're going to set up an initial conditions such that we're going to choose a state that minimizes the value of this operator. So this operator is just what shows up on the right-hand side of the Schrodinger equation at the start of inflation. This is like what Martin and Brandenburger did for their trans-Planckian setup. And this will also reduce to the usual Bunch-Davies initial conditions, assuming that the initial time for inflation has g being small. So the quantum state at the end of inflation will be determined essentially by the polymer coupling at the start of inflation, G naught. So this kind of makes sense here. So modes that have G naught less than one have physical wavelengths bigger than the polymer length scale at the start of inflation. And only as inflation proceeds, the physical wavelengths get bigger. So these modes essentially evolve entirely in the Schrodinger regime. Whereas modes with G naught bigger than one have physical wavelengths in the polymer regime. They evolve, they get larger, they stop feeling polymer effects here, and then they evolve as normal. So this is the trans-Planckian feature of inflationary cosmology. Okay, so what we can parameterize this by K star. K star is the present day wave number of a mode with a physical wave number M star at the start of inflation. And you can give it a value there in terms of simple parameters. So that's it. We need to solve a partial differential equation with those initial conditions and then evaluate an expectation value in the superhorizon regime. And we get these types of power spectra here. So what I'm plotting here is the power spectrum of the scalar field in units of h over 2 pi all squared. That's the standard result you would have got into Sitter space, the Harrison-Zeldovich spectrum. So we can see for small k, large scales, we recover the standard result, which is expected. Whereas for hot, small scales or large values of k, we get this oscillatory power spectrum. The oscillations oscillate in g naught squared there, basically in terms of k squared. The amplitude of the oscillations go to zero for the limit of m star going to infinity. And that, sorry?
What are the units?
This way?
Yes.
K star.
K or K.
K star, and K star is that. So you give me an M star over H and length of inflation, E folds of inflation, then I give you units. So the amplitude of the oscillations go to zero in the M star going to infinity limit in the sense that M star is much bigger than H. So that's a sensible result. It's also common in other approaches to the trans-Planckian problem in inflation. So that's our main result. So it's fun to throw that into a CAM or something like that and look for observational consequences. This is a terrible spectrum. It tends to integrate out in Boltzmann code, so all of these effects from these rapid oscillations tend to be a wash. So you don't get huge effects on CMB. Here's the TT temperature autocorrelation. It tends to be masked by cosmic variance for various values here. And here I took a value of K star being 5 times 10 to the minus 4 inverse megaparsecs. The situation is a little better for the matter power spectrum, because the matter power spectrum is essentially the primordial power spectrum multiplied by a transfer function, so there's nothing really fancy going on there. So what you can do is you can take the regular Harrison-Zeldovich result and get these, or a slow roll inflation result, if I'm doing things a little more carefully, and get these oscillations superimposed on them. So in particular, that takes the baryon acoustic oscillations. So if you take this matter power spectrum, you see these little bumps here. These are the baryon acoustic oscillations. If I subtract off the smooth component and I look at it here, it tends to broaden them out with the imposition of really fast oscillations on top of here, so fast that it turns into a blue line for the finite pixel width of the line that I've drawn. So already you could rule out things like M star over H by current observations. You might hope future surveys would be able to do something like constrain M star over, I think that should be bigger than 10. Oh, rule out M star over H less than 10. So, to summarize, we found polymer quantization corrections, the scale invariant spectrum of primordial perturbations. You've got an oscillatory power spectrum for k bigger than k star. The amplitude of the oscillation scales like h over m star. Very difficult to see in CMB power spectra, but maybe possible to see with baryon acoustic oscillations. Thank you.
Star is the Planck length, then what is the ratio of h over m star?
Somebody help me out. 10 to the minus 3, 10
to the minus 6.
10 to the minus 6, yeah. And one thing to note is that the corrections are of order h over m star, not h over m star squared, as in some other implementations.
Of course, this 10 to the minus 6 would be for during inflation. If you look at us acoustic oscillations, that is
ridiculously
small, I don't know. Because that's the latest phase when the universal record, that's the end of inflation.
Yeah, but this H refers to the inflationary one.
And the onset of inflation?
The average value during inflation, the typical value during inflation.
So I was talking about onset of inflation.
Okay.
So it is much, much smaller.
If you miss that, the Planck scale, mm-hmm. How many photons do you need to have oscillations during the several?
You're asking me basically about k star. If you're saying that's 10 to the 6, so that cancels off that. So e to the n, I'll bring it back down again. So basically, you're asking about the pivot scale of the spectrum there, because I can change around the pivot scale k star. So where these oscillations come in by just messing around with the number of e-foldings of inflation. So I do have some freedom there. So if I were to do a parameter search for this, or you know, actually try and constrain this, I would probably view k star as a pseudo-free parameter within a range.
Why that particular finite difference stencil?
Do other choices matter? I'm sure that they do. There are other ways to represent the operator in this. The choice or the resolution of this momentum operator is part of the quantization scheme, just as much as this M star is as well. So any finite difference stencil will have an M star. It'll have a physical scale associated with it. I don't know what the effect of other finite differences are.
Did that one oscillator first?
Yeah.
That was done by some other authors,
like. Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. You.
But it's the same result. There's no.
It's the same result. I assume Dirichlet boundary conditions, but they're the same Mathilde functions or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's basically that we are well-picked by the group.
Is this the bandwidth? I've seen the paper. I haven't read it in detail. It has to do with that lattice spacing there. I don't have any good comments on that right now, but it's something to look at.
Okay, there are no further questions.
And just continue.
Should be there. One second. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so our last speaker for today is Guillermo Minamorgan, and he will tell us about hybrid quantization of a cosmological model with inflation.
Thank you, Stephen. So this work that's been done in collaboration with Miquel Fernández Méndez, Javier Olmedo is sitting there, and José Beliño from the University of Covilha in Portugal. Essentially, what I am going to describe is quantization or particular quantization of a massive scalar field that's minimally coupled to a perturbed Freeman-Robinson-Walker universe geometry. There has been a lot of interest in this model lately. Well, in fact, it's one of the best studied models in cosmology. And the reason is that they can generate inflation. And then lately in the loop quantum cosmology, we have been paying special attention essentially because we want to extract predictions. So it's the natural way to proceed, okay? In fact, we started studying the case with closed spherical topology. The reason is that essentially the flat case is simpler. So you want to know the effects of the special curvature, the natural thing to do is to start including it. Passing from a spherical topology to flat topology, in fact, is really easy, okay? It's the most important interesting case, is the one I'm going to describe here. And the only thing we're going to assume that the special sections are compact, this has to do essentially with the infrared limit of the quantum field theory. It doesn't matter much if your compactification scale is sufficiently large. The other thing is the approximations, okay? Obviously, there are approximations that are intrinsic to the formalism that you are using. Essentially, let's say that the general idea is to use as few approximations as possible. It's almost impossible in general to check that the approximations are really valid. The best you can do in most cases is just to check the internal consistency. We usually say, okay, that you can check afterwards that the approximation is working. This is something that is almost impossible. You don't have a theory that is larger than the one that you're using. You don't have at hand such a more general formulation. It's really difficult to check the validity of your approximations, but at least to check the consistency of it, okay? So the first approximation that we are using is just truncated the action to quadratic order. This is not much different to what Hogge and Halliwell did. Manuel has been also explaining about this approach, and it is from 85, okay, so it's relatively old. This includes the back reaction, okay, of the perturbations in the action up to that order. And in particular, with, let's say, this truncation, you can also test the validity of other truncations that are less refined, okay? The other approximation that we're going to use, or assumption, is what we call the hybrid approach to a quantization. Essentially, it's assuming that the most important effects of the quantum geometry are accounting for in the quantization of the background, okay? So the idea is to, locate something or to assign something as a background, quantize it polymerically, and then the perturbations will be treated in a more standard way using quantum field theory, but not really just in a good background, but what we are calling now a quantum background, okay? This was applied successfully to Gaudi cosmologies. In that case, it's not a truncation. There is absolutely no problem there. You are not making an approximation by truncating anything. The treatment there is exact. The fact that was successful there, in fact, is giving you support in trying to follow the same procedure in other cases, okay? The other thing, in order to use this hybrid approach, all the problems that you have, okay, you are going to quantize your quantum background polymerically, but then you have the perturbations, and then you are going to use essentially quantum field theory. And we know that in good backgrounds, there is an intrinsic ambiguity in the quantization, okay? This ambiguity is infinite, and at the end of the day, can destroy the power of prediction of your theory. So in this sense, what we did is using some results that we have been, like, let's say, accumulating the last years about a way to pick up a unique fog quantization, okay, in this kind of space-times. Essentially, the idea was to use the spatial symmetries of your sections, of your background, and then demand unitarity in the evolution. Okay, you don't have a time symmetry, you're losing that part, but at least you can demand unitary evolution. The good thing of this is that it's not only possible to use that criteria, but it also helps you in something. When you are in a time-dependent background, there's a not definite way of separating what is perturbation or what is background. And in fact, this leads you to time-dependent canonical transformations in your variables. You can mix the background with your perturbations in different ways. With this criteria, you can just choose a unique way of separating this thing, scaling the perturbations in a particular way. Not only that, it also chooses you just a canonical momentum for your perturbative field. And it gives you a class of unitary equivalent fog quantizations for this canonical pair. Okay? So essentially this is what we followed. This one of the most important difference with a different approach by Abai, Ivan, and William Nelson, in the sense that the scaling of the perturbations is different. Okay? This may affect the, let's say, the effective description, what is now called the dress metric that you obtain in the formulation. And obviously also the evolution you are using a Schrödinger picture. Okay. And now for the loop quantization of the background of the Friedman-Royerson-Walker geometry, essentially, okay, we followed the standard procedure in our community, except for the fact that we applied what we call now, let's say, the prescription that we introduced Merce, Javi, and me. The main difference is that this prescription gives you superselection sectors that are semilattices. This is good because you have a surface of minimum volume, and from there you can evolve your data. So in fact, at least conceptually, you don't need an ideal clock. It's already included there. Numerically also, it's quite advantageous. At least you reduce time of computation by a factor of 16, okay? So with this philosophy, essentially we describe the variables for Friedman-Royerson-Walker in a familiar way for us, with a P essentially the degree of freedom that corresponds to the square of the scale factor, and C is the connection degree of freedom, and this is the zero mode of the scalar field, okay? And with a typical Hamiltonian constraint in Friedman-Royerson-Walker and loop quantum cosmology. Now we're going to include perturbations, okay? This is done essentially with the Fourier basis. We are using here just sines and cosines because they are real. This is the typical thing that you can also see in Hawking and Halliwell's paper. You have, well, I'm only going to describe here scalar perturbations. You can do exactly as well for tensor and vector perturbations. So this is the degree of freedom that goes with the trace of the spatial metric. This is the traceless part. And then you have here two coefficients that correspond, in fact, to Lagrange multipliers for the lapse and the shift, and the perturbations of the scalar field. And then you get your total Hamiltonian has two linear contributions with this G and K as the Lagrange multipliers, and a quadratic correction to the Hamiltonian of the Friedman-Royerson-Walker model. Okay, now what we did after this is study different gauges. I'm going to describe just briefly the longitudinal gauge in which your shift vanishes, and your spatial metric is always proportional to the flat one, okay? you can just fix the gauge in the standard way in this case. After that reduction, it is possible to find a set of variables that continue to be canonical. The only thing is that the background variables are corrected with quadratic terms in the perturbations in order to continue to form a canonical set. And you get a Hamiltonian constraint for the reduced system. There is the Friedman-Robinson-Walker one with a quadratic contribution in the perturbations. This would be like what one would expect, I mean, for typical case, in just the contribution with the frequency and the mass of the scalar field. The only thing is that there are corrections here, okay? There are subleading terms of order 1 over the square of the frequency. In fact, if you want to get rid of those terms, you can find a canonical transformation that leads you to the Muhanov-Sasaki variables. The only thing is that this transformation is not global, let's say that it's mode dependent. You have to do mode by mode, okay? We were able to prove that even in that case, the quantization is unitary equivalent. Even if you generalize 10 dependent canonical transformation to mode dependent ones that do not mix modes, okay? We did exactly the same with other gauges, in particular with the gauge of flat spatial sections. And we were also able to prove that the quantization was unitary equivalent to the one with Muhanov-Sasaki variables, and therefore with the one that we obtain in this gauge. So even if we are gauge fixing, at least the results are robust in this sense, in the sense that they do not depend critically in the gauge that you are adopting. Okay. Now, what happens if you introduce a clock, if you use Yamata's field, the zero mode, as a clock for the system, okay? So this is essentially the idea that also has been proposed by Ivan, Abai, and Wilson. So if you do it here, the first thing is that, I mean, just using a Born-Oppenheimer ansatz, in which you separate degrees of freedom of the Friedman-Robinson-Walker geometry and the degrees of freedom of the perturbations with the scalar field, let's say, the zero mode as set time, okay? So when you do that, the equation that you obtain in principle is second order differential equation, okay? You can neglect terms, and you know which terms you are neglecting in order to arrive to a first order differential equation of Schrödinger like form, okay? So from this point of view, the advantage that you have is that you know what are the terms that you are really neglecting in order to arrive there. The other thing is that now you take expectation values, you neglect non-diagonal contributions, and then you arrive to this equation. It's a little bit different, okay, to the one, for instance, obtained by Ivan Abai, in the sense that, for instance, if the field is massless, this term here does not appear, and the only thing that appears in the other contribution goes out with the expectation value of the square of the scale factor, okay? And it's what you would expect from Muhanov-Sasaki variables once you have rescaled them, okay? The other thing is that, in principle, formally, you could do something also perturbatively without introducing a matter clock, just by assuming that you can make a kind of expansion of the solution in perturbations. In fact, the different equations that you have to solve depend on the Hamiltonian or the Friedman-Robinson-Walker model. At least with our prediction, you can just fix initial data in the section of minimum volume. For the perturbations, you get a source term in the perturbations, but again, you have to solve it for the Hamiltonian or the Friedman-Robinson-Walker model. So essentially, I say formally, you can think of solutions, physical states, just by initial conditions in the section of minimum volume, and just endow them with an inner product and obtain a physical Hilbert space, okay? So conclusions, essentially, it's just a proposal for quantization of a perturbed Friedman-Robertson worker with a massive scalar field in the framework of loop quantum cosmology. We have truncated the action up to second order in the perturbations, and we have followed this hybrid screen for quantization, okay? Even after reducing the system, you still keep a symplectic structure, essentially correcting zero modes with quadratic contribution from the perturbations. The bad reaction is included in the final Hamiltonian also in this sense. In principle, you have an abstract formulation that does not need the introduction of an internal time. And if you want to go to a description, let's say, more manageable with a matter clock, then you know what are the terms that you have that you are neglecting, and you can check whether it's true that they are negligible. Okay. If you make the scaling of the perturbations that we have proposed, at that moment, what you get in the regime of a quantum field theory with a Dress metric is a theory that has a unitary evolution. Okay. So in this sense, for that description, the Schrödinger and the Heisenberg picture will be exactly, will be unitary equivalent. And if at least conceptually you don't want to introduce a matter clock, you can always try to do the quantization using the section of minimum volume, okay? So that's all.
Considering an unitary evolution, my understanding of this is that you are choosing the regime in which you are working somehow, because we know that for general covariance system, the evolution is not unitary in the sense that you evolve your state into mixed state. Here you are choosing somehow a regime in which you can work with the standard quantum field theory, is it right?
Yes. Okay. So. Also, the good thing about our, let's say, theorems for the uniqueness of the Fock quantization is that you only need a finite interval of time. It doesn't matter how small, finite interval of time, okay? At that moment, you really pick out a unique Fock quantization. So if you assume that there is a regime in which the quantum field theory is valid, then this is the natural thing to do, okay?
I didn't understand your question. I don't think it's true that for generally covariant theories there is firstly a good mixed state. That's not.
This is what I have understood from Ward 2 weeks ago in Warsaw, and what I have understood from the talks in the
right. So that's not right. So for generally covariant theories, it's not necessarily the case. It is only if you're actually tracing on some degrees of freedom, like in the case of black hole evaporation, when you trace over the horizon in the freedom, and you're just going looking for square minus to square plus. And that is a pure state goes to mixed state. In cosmology context, you're not neglecting anything. You are really
of course we are neglecting something. I mean, we take only the degrees of freedom. I mean, we have
But we're not neglecting anything within the theory. Even in quantum field theory on the black hole space time, of course you're neglecting all kinds of things. But the theory is just classical black hole together with the scalar field. In that theory, what one is doing is tracing all the degrees of freedom. Cosmological case, the theory, by definition of Guillermo, is Friedman-Robertson Walker background plus perturbation. The question is, if in fact within this theory, dynamics is unitary or not. I'm not tracing on any degrees of freedom. I'm going from a Cauchy surface to a Cauchy surface.
I was at that talk too. I think the point was that if you change the second Cauchy surface has a
second is not a Cauchy surface. That's the whole point of the talk was the second thing is not a Cauchy surface. And that is why information can leak, because you have got geodesics, which is intersect the first Cauchy surface and not meet the hyperbolic. They can just go to null infinity. So the information can leak out there. That'll okay.
We'll discuss it later.
Yeah, maybe we can discuss it also during your
I have a question. So these results about the uniqueness of the quantization, you say it's for massive scalar fields. but with any kind of master or any kind of potential?
In principle, it's just proof for a time-dependent mass, okay? Not for any kind of potential. The problem is that you have to generalize it in the sense that the equation will not be linear anymore, okay? The field equations for our potentials, they depend on the field, not quadratically, okay? So what is proof is just for a time-dependent mass or anything that you can somehow reformulate in that term. So you can play with changes of time, because it's unitarity. We are not saying anything about the generator, so you can change the time level. There's no problem in that. And the other thing is, for scaling, we know that there is only one, this acceptable. But any field equation that you can obtain from Klein-Gordon with time-dependent mass in that way is valid. This is something that Laura is doing now, okay?
Is it that? We can postpone to the discussion session, I don't think.
Sure. I just want to take this last question. Just to understand, this Hamiltonian is a constraint or is a physical Hamiltonian?
Constraint one. You can deparameterize, including introducing something that you use as a time. But what you have there is a constraint.
So the evolution is the special
one? Is
there evolution?
If you deparameterize, yes. Otherwise, like the usual thing that you have at that perturbative order, symmetry and the reparametrization.
Okay.
Okay, of the time.
Is that in a fixed gauge?
Yes, but if you don't fix the gauge, what you have is the total Hamiltonian. That would be the Freeman-Rosen-Walker corrected with perturbations, and then also adding two linear contributions, okay, that essentially come from the fact that you have a perturbed shift and you have a perturbed lapse, okay? So you will have a total Hamiltonian formed by the sum of these constraints, okay?
So you can make the Fitzing consistent with the Fitzing consistent introducing a particular lapse.
The thing I say is that if you just study a perturbed system, at that order of truncation, you will get a constraint, a total Hamiltonian that is a sum of constraint. Then you can fix the gauge. For instance, just introducing conditions that allow you to remove the two linear constraints. Okay? There are different possibilities, and they have been used in cosmology. I mean, they are like familiar things for us. If you fix the gauge, okay, then the thing that you are left in this case is just a global Hamiltonian constraint. Just one, a global one, it's not at each point, okay? It's like correcting the Freeman-Rosen-Walker with a contribution. There's like kind of back reaction, you want to call it like this. And it's quadratic in the perturbations.
Do you have solutions of both the background and the perturbations? With the
Bacharachian? You mean quantum ones? No. Yeah, but numerically, you can do it.
You can do it?
I mean, this. Javi is making the integration with the back reaction, yes.
Do you expect those solutions, let's say, for the background with back reaction, to be very different from the ones that apply?
No. If you have, I mean, essentially, this is like common sense, okay? If you have something that is really picked in the background, really, really big. Okay? It doesn't matter the momenta that you use to describe it. Okay, that's the first thing. The second thing is that if you use for the perturbation something that whose back reaction is really, really small, it will not change much.
But you are not deparametrizing, so...
I mean, once again, the thing I'm saying that it's just numerical simulations for the effective dynamics or whatever you want to call, okay? I mean, doing this quantum mechanically, I don't know. But it's true that you can try to use approximation methods, okay?